This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Chad Daybell back in the Fremont County Court today. Motions filed by John Pryor, Daybell's defense attorney, and prosecutors Lindsay Blake and Rob Wood regarding a change of venue for the trial, cameras in the courtroom, and taking the death penalty off the table, amongst other issues to be discussed today. Let's go right to the courtroom to hear the audio.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're back on the record on CR 22-21-1623. The court took under advisement briefly its ruling on the issue of a reconsideration of video and photographic coverage of this case, including the trial. A couple of notes the court will have in making this decision. The court has listened to arguments of the state requesting that we keep the case status quo. And I'll note we did conduct a trial in the Lori Vallow case, which was initially joined with this case, later severed and tried in Boise during the process of those proceedings in order to allow some additional access. The court did permit a broadcasting on a limited basis of that trial to two separate locations where the public could view outside of the courtroom. One was a location in Ada County in their courthouse, and then a second location in Rexburg, Idaho. And there were certain reasons for doing that, mainly the fact that venue was changed and the case was taken so far from this location where the home counties are. So that factors into the court's decision. This is now a trial of Mr. Daybell. One of the big concerns I had also for the initial trial was potentially tainting jurors for what I knew would be a second trial coming up if the entire proceedings were broadcast from the Lori Vallow trial, concluding that anyone who had watched that trial or portions of it would likely be unable to serve as a qualified juror in this case. The court has also heard the request from the defense and the rationale for allowing broadcasting of the proceedings, including trial, and the court's considered the briefing and arguments submitted by Ms. Olson for her various media clients who are requesting the ability to conduct broadcasting and photography of the trial during the proceedings. A few things I'll note. First of all, under Idaho Court Administrative Rule 45B, the court has the discretion to make this determination. That rule reads that the presiding judge may, at his or her discretion, limit, restrict, or prohibit audio, video, audio or visual coverage of any proceeding. And those decisions are not subject to appellate review. I am compelled by some of the arguments that a difficulty in moving a trial about 350 miles away from where we currently are certainly restricts access by certain individuals that wish to attend. The argument by Mr. Pryor that the defendants got family members that would like to see the proceedings is a compelling argument. I know from the last case also there are other individuals, family members of victims, family members of defendants, and others very interested in the case or connected to it, which were unable to attend because of the location. I'll note also that the court still has under advisement, and we'll hear argument later this morning about changing venue, but as I sit here to make this decision, we're currently scheduled for trial to occur again in Ada County in this case. In balancing out the requests here, the court is determined or has made a determination that in order to provide adequate access, the court is going to permit that the trial be broadcast while it occurs with certain restrictions. First, the court is going to be in charge of all equipment and the broadcasting of that. I'm not going to allow that to be conducted by any third parties. The court has the equipment to do so. We did that in the previous trial when it was broadcast to those other locations. It worked well in all the reporting I got back from those that attended and those that ran the system. And with the equipment to do that and the court's own website, which provides an ability to stream it live from the State of Idaho Judiciary website, public is given free and unfettered access to view the proceedings that way. So with that in mind, the court won't allow any still photography, given that the matter will be broadcast on video through the court's own system. And in addressing some of the other concerns as it relates to any microphones placed by any media or third party, of course, those will not be allowed because the court's going to use its own equipment to broadcast the proceedings. And in addition, there were concerns about the exclusionary rule, so witnesses who would be testifying not being allowed to view the proceedings before they testify. I'll note that was already a concern in the first trial with Ms. Ballow, and we had an affidavit that addressed that and required each witness to certify under oath that they had not viewed the proceedings, and did in fact run across a few witnesses who were not able to do that and took those matters up outside the jury. I think that system worked well to make sure that there was not any improper influence on testifying witnesses. So the court will employ that same method of allowing witnesses to testify only after they've been able to certify under oath that they haven't been tainted by viewing previous testimony. There will be some additional technical terms of how the court will allow the broadcasting, and those will be followed up on in a subsequent written order that I'll enter into the case before trial. Going forward with other pretrial hearings, the court will take those up on a case-by-case basis, but this will be the ruling for the trial and how publicity will be handled. So I have balanced out also the concern of certain witnesses who don't wish to be captured on recording forever, and I understand that, and I've had to balance that out. I'd note at the last proceeding, they were also photographed whether they wanted to be or not as they went in and out of the courthouse because it's a public area, and the media was pretty persistent in trying to capture images and pictures of them. So there's really not any way to completely prohibit that. And while that's unfortunate for those that do not enjoy being on camera or all the publicity, that's just part of the stress, I guess, of being involved in a case like this and having to testify. So the court is going to amend its current order as it relates to the case. And as I mentioned, I'll follow up with some additional detail in a written order, but I wanted the parties to be aware of where this would be heading as we get closer to trial. So that will be the court's ruling on the motion at this time. Mr. Wood, does the state have any questions on that ruling?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pryor, any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And Ms. Olson, any comment or question? All right. Thank you. That will conclude the first motion then. The next motion we will bring up, if the parties are ready to proceed, will be the state's motion to amend the indictment. This is a motion that the state filed on November 13th of 2023, and a response and objection was filed by Mr. Pryor on behalf of his client on November 17th, 2023, and the court's prepared now to hear argument on that. Who will be arguing on behalf of the state?
I will be arguing this one, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Blake, are you ready to proceed with argument?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, you may go ahead.
Thank you. Idaho Criminal Rule 7E and Idaho Code 19-1420 are the governing authorities regarding amending indictments. Both of them make clear, Idaho Code essentially reflects very similar language to the Idaho Criminal Rule 7E. It adds some additional language regarding prior to the plea being made by a defendant that an indictment or information may be amended. Since we're post the plea of not guilty, not focusing on that part of the section. But essentially both Idaho Criminal Rule and the Idaho Code allow that prior to the prosecution resting the case, an indictment or information may be amended so long as no additional charges are added and the defendant is not prejudiced by the change. We filed this motion approximately 6 months before what will be the start of the defendant's trial. So our position would be that the defendant is on adequate notice as to the request to modify the indictment. I would also indicate that for the benefit of counsel and the court, I did submit a proposed amended indictment with the changes italicized for the benefit of court and counsel to be able to observe those. That was submitted just by email, waiting to determine whether or not the amendments would be approved prior to submitting a new filing. There were three main amendments that the state is asking to modify. I will indicate they reflect the same modifications that were requested and granted in the co-defendant's trial. The first one is to modify the subsections referenced in counts 1 and counts 3. Those are the counts dealing with conspiracy to commit first-degree murder and grand theft. They are specifically dealing with the code sections referencing the grand theft. It would be a request to change it from 18-24034A to 18-24032A. The state's position on that is it actually is more reflective of the language contained within the current indictment, not specific to the defendant, but there was a charge of grand theft. That charge reflected the language regarding that the theft occurred by deception. When we look at the case law in Idaho, looking first to State v. Ghana, 117 Idaho 83, and that's an Idaho Court of Appeals case from 1989, it specifically outlines the purpose of the information is to allow defendant notice and opportunity to prepare a defense. And in State v. Bolas, 93 Idaho 749, that's a Supreme Court case from 1970, there was an amendment made changing the code section from one that described the differences between first and second degree burglary to the code section that defined the crime of burglary itself. And the court found that there was no issue with making that modification. The defendant wasn't prejudiced. The court found the defendant was always on notice that the underlying charge was burglary. In addition, when we look to State v. Dunn, that's 60 Idaho 568, again, a Supreme Court case from 1939. The court found there was no substantial difference to the charge of, to whether or not the charge of obtaining money by false pretenses was that the defendant received or executed the contract. The court found the defendant was charged essentially with having fabricated the contract, regardless of the method in which that fabrication occurred. And again, they found that there was no substantial change. The defendant was properly on notice. There was no prejudice to the defendant. And then in State v. Severson, 147 Idaho 694, that's again an Idaho Supreme Court case, but from 2009, the court laid out the relevant factors to determining whether the defendant was prejudiced is whether it took the defendant by surprise, impaired defendant's ability to adequately prepare a defense, subjected the defendant to double jeopardy, or required extensive further preparation by the defendant in preparing for trial. In Severson specifically, the court found the amendment merely alleged an alternative way defendant may have committed the crime. None of the defendant's substantial rights were prejudiced. Essentially, in that case, the state added a theory that the victim in that case had died from suffocation. And the court found that that did not modify the charge itself. It didn't add a new charge. And the defendant was properly on notice with no prejudice. In this case, the state would say we're in a similar position. The requested amendment does not add a new charge. It simply modifies the subsection under which defendant is accused of having committed the crime. The defendant's properly on notice. In addition, the indictment contains language reflective of that subsection 2A. If anything, the state increases the burden by having to prove the crime was committed through some use of deceit versus simply that a theft itself occurred, that it was simply knowingly, we add that element of deceit. So if anything, it would increase our burden. In addition to that, the state would indicate the actual charge isn't the grand theft itself, especially with regard to the defendant here today. The actual charge is conspiracy. It's just one of the elements is the it incorporates the elements of the grand theft as part of that conspiracy. So we think that that is an appropriate amendment. We think we're doing it in plenty of time to give the defendant advance notice of that modification. In addition to the fact, one could argue the defendant was on notice during the course of the co-defendant's trial when the state made these modifications, knowing he was charged under that same indictment. So I think the defendant is on adequate notice. There is no prejudice and there is no additional charge with that change. The next requested change would be for, I reference the correct counts.
On that last point, Ms. Blake, I'm not sure you could deem it notice where in the first case that the amendment occurred right before the state rested at the end of the case. And then knowing that this issue was in the indictment here, it's up to the state to make that amendment and change it. So I guess they could speculate that you were going to do that. Until such time as we're here, I don't think they're really on notice that that's happening until we argue it as we're doing today.
And I can appreciate that point. I guess the fact that it was amended would have at least given some indication that there could be the potential. I would agree the actual notice was not until the filing of the document. There had been some discussions amongst the state and defense counsel that we would be filing a motion to amend the indictment, but I would agree until the actual filing, it isn't considered official notice. But I think they were aware of that occurrence during the co-defendant's trial. Looking at counts 1, 3, and 5, the state is requesting to add the language and or between the co-defendants listed in that or the co-conspirators and or potential co-conspirators. The state's position, similarly, we look under that same test, and the state's position is this clearly does not add a new charge, and we would also argue it does not prejudice the defendant. In addition to that argument, in State v. Yang, 167 Idaho 944, it's an Idaho Court of Appeals case from 2020. While it was a touch different because this was a case in which they were asking to modify a jury instruction to be given regarding the co-conspirators in the case versus amending an information or an indictment, the court found that adding the language and or was not a substantial change to the jury instruction. What the court essentially found is it is not incumbent on the state or necessary to prove the number of co-conspirators or the identity of each co-conspirator. It's simply that there was an agreement with at least one other person and one of those parties committed an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. So knowing that those aren't officially elements of the case, I think looking at State v. Yang, that provides clarification and the guidance that this would be an appropriate modification. In addition to that, we are asking for this well in advance of trial to put the defendant on notice that we would be asking for that modification. I don't think that changes anything with regard to the elements of the crime or the burden required. And I think that has clearly been litigated in the courts here. The last one that the state had noted in the motion itself to amend the indictment was a change to count 5 and specifically overt act number 10. The state is asking to change the month to months with adding the S. Essentially, it was a typographical error requesting that it be changed to the months before. And looking again at some of the cases we've cited to before, Ghana, the defendant had argued that he was not on proper notice because the state added a charge of persistent violator 3 weeks before trial. The court found that was sufficient notice in amending that 3 weeks before trial to add that. And then again, looking at the test outlined in Severson, the state's position is this does not add a new charge and it does not create any prejudice to the defendant. It is not a double jeopardy issue. It's not going to create any kind of extensive preparation by the defense or further preparation by the defense. In addition, the state would argue similarly that this modification was made during the co-defendant's trial. The defendant has been in possession of the discovery in relation to this case. The defendant has had the benefit of watching the co-defendant's trial and are observing and listening to it, where it is clear that this was what was presented during the trial, was that it included the months. In the amended indictment sent to the court and counsel, there were a few other italicized proposed changes. Those were not specifically addressed in the motion. They're simply typographical errors or errors where certain language was left out. I could go through those, but essentially the state's position would be similar to what we just argued with the months. They're not adding new charges. There's no prejudice to the defendant. We're bringing them in advance of trial, requesting permission. The state does recognize that it is in the discretion of the court once a plea has been entered by the defendant, whether or not a state is allowed to amend an indictment or information. However, both the rule and code make clear that before the prosecution has rests, that it is appropriate to bring the motion. So with that, the state would request that the court grant this motion to amend the indictment reflective of the changes sent to the court and counsel.
All right, one question, Ms. Blake, on some of the proposed amendments here. If you have it in front of you, the proposed amended indictment.
Yes.
Page 6, there's common scheme or plan in Fremont is how it reads now, and it says Fremont and Madison counties.
Yes.
Do you want to address whether or not that would be permitted pursuant to the rule, or does that require any further findings by the grand jury?
I don't believe it requires any further findings by the grand jury for the reason that it was simply a typographical error and left out. When you read the count and the contents of it, it includes in the county of Fremont, state of Idaho, and elsewhere, including Madison County, Idaho, and as part of a continuing criminal transaction and common scheme or plan in Fremont counties. So, and Madison was simply left out of there. In the same body of that count itself, it includes Madison County already. So it was simply to correct the confusion that may be from Fremont and then having counties and Madison was simply left out. But the rest of the indictment and the information presented included acts in both Fremont and Madison County. And that's what has always been purported and alleged by the state. So I would argue similarly, it doesn't modify anything. It doesn't modify it as far as a new charge, and it doesn't prejudice the defendant. I don't think it creates any kind of a venue or jurisdiction issue either, especially given what's in the body of the rest of the indictment. It would simply be to alleviate any confusion that may be seen there by having simply Fremont and then the plurality.
All right. Thanks for the response on that. All right. The state submitted its argument in support of the motion. Mr. Pryor, if you'd like to present your argument in opposition, you may.
Judge, there's no doubt that the prosecuting attorney has a right to amend the indictment right up before the close of their case. And again, I was aware of some of these. I'm not going to argue the month or months. I think that's given what they've represented, that's appropriate. In addition, in terms of the overt acts that they talk about, including the language of Madison County, I guess.
Could you just pull the mic a little closer there? We're not picking up the recording.
That was not good.
Alternative, you can argue standing or from counsel table either way.
Judge, in addition, I guess I could make an argument. Is that acceptable? The level of noise, sound?
It's still a little quiet, the clerk says.
That any better?
Yes.
I'll try to lean forward and talk that. Judge, I've never been accused of not having a loud voice, so this is new for me. And the court's smiling. Court's aware of that as well. Thank you. Judge, in regards to the Madison County, quite frankly, the state is right, and at least in this perspective, they're right. They alleged in the actual body of the language that Madison County was above that and about two lines above the change they're alleging. They actually mentioned Madison County. So for me to suggest that they can't do that would, I think, be improper. So I'll agree to them allowing that. There is an argument, I guess, in terms of bringing it back to the grand jury to make a representation about the venue, but I'm not going to engage in that today. However, what I am, Judge, going to engage in is the language on counts 1, 3, and 5. This is my concern. I understand the previous case Ms. Blake represented talked about that the and or was not dramatic change in terms of what's represented. But the concern I have with this judge is if you look at the actual indictment and look at the language, they're alleging that Lori Vallow and or Chad Daybell and or Alex Cox and or the other conspirators that were involved in this case. Now, to date, and there we dealt with this before, we have no idea who the names of these other conspirators are, or at least the state hasn't disclosed the other conspirators that were involved in this case. But the concern is that it shifts the burden, and it changes the burden that the state's going to have to prove. And how it does that is this, is that a jury who are not legally educated citizens are going to look at the indictment and say, well, under this particular allegation, we don't actually even need to prove Mr. Daybell did anything wrong. What we have to prove is that, well, it could have been Lori Vallow or Alex Cox or the other conspirators. Don't even need to prove Chad Daybell to find him guilty. All we have to do is that the others were involved in this. That's all that, and that kind of logical thinking can go towards what the jury would be thinking about this. And unfortunately, if that's what they want to do, then they need to take this back to the grand jury and have them approve this language and say, we're going to indict Mr. Daybell because and or can be defined as meaning whether he could have done it, yeah, and he could have been there, or it could have been the others. But if it's just the others and not Mr. Daybell, we're still going to find him guilty because the amendments that the state is alleging in terms of count one, count three, and count five, that sort of thinking can take place. And that is my concern. And it's confusing. And I know Mr. Archibald touched on this at the time, and the court allowed these changes to go forward. But my concern, again, is this, Judge, is that the plain reading of that language by including and or between the unnamed co-conspirators that we don't know I don't know who the names are, Alex Cox, Lori Vallow, and Chad Daybell, the state put and or on all of the names, change that, and that in essence changes how the plain reading of that particular phrase could be interpreted. That is my concern. And it's enough of a concern, Judge, that technically, you could look at this and say, Mr. Daybell could be found guilty of 1, 3, and 5 without having done anything, given that the others, or the others could have been involved and they could impute that onto Mr. Daybell. That's my concern. Lastly, I understand that they're alleging grand theft under 2403. My concern is that they alleged it in front of the grand jury under one particular section of 2403. They are now changing that to a different section under 2403. The case law is not clear at this point as to whether or not changing the underlying charge or any of the subsections, it doesn't address that. It does say that if you change the underlying charge, that could be problematic. Doesn't address whether changing the subsection and the level of proof that they're going to do. And I would concede to the state that it's not 6 months, Ms. Blake, it's 4 months before we start the trial, less than 4 months at this point. But I would concede, Judge, that if the court finds that just changing the subsection is not enough of a change, obviously I would accept the court's decision, but it is a different subsection under the grand theft charge, and it does require a different burden of proof. And the state saying that it's made it more difficult on them, I don't agree with that. What they've done is they've changed the subsection on what they're trying to get Mr. Daybell convicted of under the crime of grand theft to a different subsection. That is a change, no matter how you put it. Whether or not it's permissible, I'll leave that to the court's decision.
All right, thank you for the argument, Mr. Pryor. Ms. Blake, do you have any rebuttal argument?
Just briefly, Your Honor, as the state indicated with regard to the grand theft, the actual charge is conspiracy. And so I would indicate that again, as well as the cases previously cited, which have in the past allowed for amendments that change the theory of how a case or under which elements or theory presented under subsections the crime was committed doing. In addition to that, I think State v. Yang makes very clear that regarding a conspiracy, the state is not required to prove the number of co-conspirators, and they're not required to prove the identity of the co-conspirators. again, a conspiracy, the state's burden would be to prove that there was a plan engaged in, a common scheme or plan, and that at least one of the actors engaged in that plan committed an overt act. There is no requirement that every person engaged in a conspiracy commit an overt act. So I think to indicate that somehow others' actions may be imputed to Mr. Daybell, that probably is not a wrong assessment by the defense, that that's the nature of a conspiracy, is any one of the co-conspirators committing a bad act does in fact is one of the elements of a conspiracy. So I don't think in any way modifying the and or adds any additional burden on the defendant, and in no way is it burden shifting. The state's requirements under conspiracy remain the same.
All right, thank you, Ms. Blake. All right, I'm prepared to make a ruling at this time on the motion. This is the state's motion to amend the indictment in this case. The court will note under Idaho Code 19-1420 that there reads amendment of indictment may be amended by the prosecuting attorney without leave of the court before a plea. We're after a plea here, so at any time thereafter in the discretion of the court, where it can be done without prejudice to the substantial rights of the defendant. So that's the standard the court looks at contained in that statute. There are some clerical amendments being requested, and there are some substantive amendments being requested in the state's new proposed indictment. The court's looked at the case law on this issue. There's a case, State versus Jeske, 164 Idaho 862, and it's a 2019 case that says the decision to permit an amendment is a matter within the discretion of the trial court. And then that case also cites to a case, State versus Severson, 147 Idaho 694. The court may allow an amendment of an information, and in this case, an indictment would apply at any time before the prosecution rests, so long as doing so does not prejudice the defendant's substantial rights or charge the defendant with a different offense, and then citing to Criminal Rule 7 and Section 19-1420 that I just mentioned. So there's discretion here for the court to consider it, starting with the clerical corrections requested. And included among those, the addition of the word Madison County on page 6. The court finds that the state's motion is permitted pursuant to Idaho Code 19-1420 on what I'll consider the proposed amendments that are clerical in nature. So the motion's granted on that. Going to the more substantive requests of the state, primarily on counts 1, 3, and 5, where there's a request to amend the stated statute under which grand theft by deception is contained in the indictment. Initially, it was listed as 2C, I believe, which is, or was it D? What was the initial, I know it's being changed to 2A if you have it amended, but what was the subsite that was in the initial indictment? I could pull it up.
We have it as 4A, Your Honor, that it was initially under 4A.
4A. Thank you for the direction there. The theft statute is kind of a large statute, but the request is that under 4A, which would be by possession of stolen property, it's to be amended to 2A, which was theft by deception. The court will note I did previously look at a similar request to amend in the prior case, and that's relevant here. And I'm talking about the Lori Vallow case, the 1624 case, because the indictment is the same between the cases and the parties here. So I noted then when I considered that at trial and allowed the amendment that the language of the indictment has read by deception and it would comport with the offense under the 2403A under 2A to be theft by deception. I don't find that that constitutes a new charge or a different charge. The either grand jurors or trial jurors are not pulling out the code to read the code cites to see if that's what the offense is. They simply follow the instructions of the court that are provided that list out the elements of a crime. And the question here is whether or not Mr. Daybell was adequately put on notice of the theory of the state's offense as it relates to the theft part of this conspiracy charge. And because it was listed as theft by deception all along in the caption, and because also the language within those counts 1, 3, and 5 described theft by deception, the court does find that allowing the amendment to 2A more accurately describes the statute upon which the defendant's been charged and does not constitute a new charge, nor does that result in a prejudice to the substantial rights. I'll allow the amendment then on those provisions, also noting that at this point, we are still in advance of trial, not real far in advance of trial, but enough in advance of trial that the defendant is adequately advised of what the charges are. I don't find that any of the proposed amendments either would require resubmission to the grand jury for a determination that probable cause was found on these offenses and that this can be amended by motion, which the state has done today. Finally, I would also agree with the state's position here that on the and or provisions that the underlying offense as actually charged here is the conspiracy offense. And under conspiracy law, the state's burden here is to show a common scheme or plan as alleged in an overt act. And the case law, including the Yang case cited by Ms. Blake, permits the state to have alternatively listed co-conspirators following conspiracy law. And because it's charged as conspiracy on those counts, I also find that does not result in any new charge or a prejudice to the substantial rights of the defendant. So I find the motion to be timely at this point. The court will grant the motion to amend the indictment, and the proposed amended indictment as received by the court will be allowed to be filed in the case. And that will be the indictment that will instruct the jurors at trial. That'll be the court's ruling on the motion then. Ms. Blake, do you have any questions on that?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Pryor, any questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, counsel. The next motion before the court is the state's renewed motion to reconsider the change of venue. This motion was filed by the state on November 15th, 2023. The defendant filed their response and objection to the motion on November 17th, and this relates to the court's pending decision or current decision that the trial will be conducted in Ada County. Who's going to be arguing that motion today?
I will be, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Blake, are you ready to proceed with argument on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Why don't we do this? Let's have a quick about 5-minute break in case there are any one here that wishes to either use the restroom or leave before we proceed with the rest of the motions. So we'll take a quick recess and then come back on and start with the change of venue motion.
All rise.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.